it's snowing again in Denver. Yay! Cool. Baseball season.
Yeah, it's been chilly here too. It was like windy when I was walking home yesterday, which is like the same thing as winter.
Shut up. Hey. Hey, dude.
Hey. Hey, what's up?
On? Welcome in. It's episode number 72.
Yeah, right?
The Purple Dinosaur Podcast. I'm Tyler Ron.
I'm Anthony Masterson. 72, the number of degrees it is going to be in Southern California today.
Let's see what it's going to be here. Let's see. Right now, out the window, snowing. Just as a quick sidebar before we get rolling today. So as many know, it's 35 right now, high of 39. As many nice. Know, I adopted a little dog 3 months ago now, which is crazy. The day the Broncos beat the Patriots to go to the Super Bowl, I adopted a little Australian cattle dog. And one thing I've learned about this little dog is she does not dig the weather. She does not dig anything, any type of moisture coming out of the sky. She's not a fan of.
Not a fan.
So last night, and I had a video of this from a couple weeks ago when it was snowing here that I should send you, but last night, I get done with work. I work night shifts for MILB, so I'm done with work. It's, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, all right, well, I should take you out before we go to bed. So I open the door. When I open the door to let her outside and it's snowing or raining, she'll go halfway out, and then she'll look up and see that it's snowing or raining, and she'll stop, and then she'll just turn around and go back inside. And I could not get her to go outside and go use the lawn at all.
Use the facilities.
Yeah. And so I got a good dog for myself, because you ever had, like, for people out there who've had pets, dogs who just like want to do nothing but hang out in the snow are the worst, because they're adorable, so you don't want to stop them, but you're also freezing your ass off.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, so I'm happy with that with this dog. But yeah, it's snowing. Rockies postponed yesterday with the Pirates. They could have played that game, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe for the best they didn't.
Yeah, probably.
How the first three games had gone in that series. It's okay.
The Pittsburgh Pirates, by the way, have won, I believe now, 8 straight at Coors Field, which is the second longest active streak.
Yeah, that is correct. They have absolutely owned the Rockies as of late.
The Angels have a winning streak of 9 games in a row at Coors Field, but that dates back to like 2002.
Yeah,
something crazy over Interleague. So this is really just like recent Pirates teams have been really, really good.
Like since they got good with Clint Hurdle.
Yeah.
Since
they drafted and developed, which is a scam.
Yeah. Once they got a pitching whisperer.
Yeah.
So anyway. We'll touch this really quickly. Big news last night. Dee Gordon getting busted for PEDs, testing positive, having something in his system, went through the appeals process, and then dropped the appeal last night, and it came out like 11 minutes after he had got the game-winning balk. Brought on by Pedro Baez,
which was
in that Dodgers
cool.
game, and the Marlins
so
swept.
Fun to watch.
Marlins swept the Dodgers in a 4-game series, and like 6 minutes later, their leadoff hitter, starting second baseman, guy who won a batting title last year, led the league in stolen bases, led the league in hits last year, and he's gone for half the season.
Yep.
Dee Gordon last year was the first NL player to lead his league in hits, stolen bases, and batting average since Honus Wagner did for the Pirates in 1908.
Honus Wagner is pretty good.
Guys have done it in the American League since then, but in the National League, the last guy to do it was Honus Wagner. Like,
pretty good.
It's
pretty good.
Yeah, and predictably, the people on Twitter today are going nuts about it. Like, there's a lot of writers saying that the union should be basically dissolved because of one guy getting caught for cheating. My favorite thing was, well, that whenever someone gets caught for PEDs, is that, oh, the system is broken, people are still cheating. The system is working, you morons.
This is like, if you arrested somebody,
working, they're catching guys who are cheating.
You arrested somebody for grand larceny.
Not working.
And people were like, nope. We gotta rethink this whole legal system if we're catching all these people on grand larceny charges. No, you want to be catching them because the system, like, kind of the point, right? Like, you don't want to just let this go unabated, which is what had happened in the past.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really get that line of logic.
No.
Not following.
And like Justin Verlander had some tweets last night. Brent McCarthy had some tweets last night saying that it's ridiculous these guys were able to play while they're in the process.
Brett
of
Anderson had a real burner.
Yeah, well, as he always does.
He's such a dork. He comes out with such dorky dad jokes. His yesterday was, man, big day for drugs and sports. Because Laramie Tunsil and this, like, oh, you're hilarious, yeah. Brett Anderson.
Good one, Brett.
Anyway.
So, I listen, to a certain extent, I get it, of course. I mean, you want all to be on the level playing field. You want guys doing it the right way. That's the whole point of putting testing in place, which is why players have voted to increase testing over the last couple of years. And now the first offense is 80 games. It used to be like 25, I think. Now first is 80, second's a full season, third, you're banned for life. Ask Henry Mejia how that works. Yeah. But to say that these policies that the union voted for, by the way, are inaccurate or that they shouldn't be put in place and guys shouldn't be able to appeal when they get a positive test, I'm not sure that's the whole route they want to go, especially with the CBA coming up, next year? I'm not sure that's one they're going to want to revisit, because that would mean giving the owners a lot more power in a certain extent, because it seems like a lot of the water carriers for MLB and the unions are saying right now that, and the or the owners are saying that they want, give teams a chance to void contracts, terminate contracts. If a guy gets busted for PEDs, it's like, whoa, okay, that's going to go back on 60 years of labor work that the union has done to become probably the most powerful union in America. I mean, MLBPA is incredible because they can get guys paying for PEDs like this. And D. Gordon has signed a $50 million contract in the offseason, and he'll lose some of it, of course, while he's suspended, but he still gets to keep that money. That's an incredible union. Guy gets busted and had his name drawn through the mud for pretty much the rest of his career, and he still gets paid his $50 million. That's one hell of a union.
Yeah, the idea that this is somehow the players' union being weak or the players' union needing to change, I don't think people really understand how players' unions work. I want to see how players' union works, or unions in general. I want to see how players' unions work. Go ahead and take a look at Tom Brady, who is just somehow suspended by a court without really much of any recourse except for legally on his own, because his union agreed to just hand off disciplinary proceedings unilaterally to a dude with no experience in ever dealing them out, who's had basically all of his landmark disciplinary decisions overturned by courts or arbiters of some point, of some repute. That's a weak union. When you just say, okay, you can do this, because if you don't do this, then
yeah. And people screaming about the guaranteed contracts in baseball, it's like, well,
who do you think negotiated those?
That's one. It's like two, and then you just basically want MLB to become the NFL. Because, Colin Kaepernick signs a $120 million contract, $11 million guaranteed. It's like, no, that's not how these contracts work. The point of baseball, and what's great about baseball, is that it's not the NFL, because the NFL sucks. The point of MLB is that their guaranteed contracts are in place. There's no salary cap, and teams are still really good on tiny payrolls. It's fine. The system is not broken. The system is working. That is why these guys are getting busted. And there's always this outrage right when something happens. You get six or eight big suspensions a year. Like, not even big, six or eight, just in general suspensions a year for PEDs. We've had two already. The fact they put in this stronger testing and the players voted for it, that's great. If you want to police yourselves in a certain way and make it harder for guys to cheat the game, great. Are guys still going to do it? Hell yeah. If they get caught, they're going to get punished. That's the point of having a system in place, and the system is clearly not broken.
Jay Jaffe of Sports Illustrated just tweeted a moment ago, who is one of the really good follows, he's awesome, and not just for baseball stuff, but he posts pictures of his 800-year-old dog Pearl, who's among the cutest dogs you'll ever see. He just tweeted 39 seconds ago, quote, "With regards to D. Gordon's punishment and the timing of it, due process and collective bargaining are features of the system, not bugs." That really hits a nail on the head. I think everybody freaks out as to, and this is another thing that we saw with Henry Mejia, was, well, does he get to appeal? Yeah, he's been appealing. The suspension gets announced when the appeals have been exhausted. That's how this works in baseball. It's how it's always worked in baseball. It's not just, this guy is banged, and all of a sudden, this is going to be a giant legal fight. I'm trying to remember another league that has gone through that. Oh, right, it went to the Court of Appeals with Tom Brady. So these are things that baseball has built in eventualities for. This is the way the system is supposed to work.
Yeah. that's the whole point of having the system in place.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. The people, I don't understand like how they're just think that the union should be dissolved. The owners should have the option to terminate contracts. Yeah, dude, let's just, you know, let's do a hard cap and let's, you know, let's have guys being paid like indentured servants again. Like, you know, owners have all the power once again. Let's bring Kennesaw Mountain Landis back. I'm sure he has some people around.
He's probably got some ideas.
He's got some, you know, great grand nieces, great grand nephews coming around. I'm sure that's great. Yeah. Bring him back.
Yeah. Even Ryan Spielberg's today. Issue with D, I question if he cheated last year. All-star, gold glove, batting champ, gets huge contract with season. He gets windfall. Others in MLB don't. Like, dude, you're never going to stop walking that line back then. Because then forever, you can look at any player. And that was another thing. Last night, Jeff Sullivan had tweeted at @based_ball. Jeff Sullivan of Fangraphs. Yeah, also a great follow. He tweeted, quote, "The best part of D. Gordon getting busted for steroids is now Stephen A. Smith has a justification for accusing literally anyone."
Yep.
This is the thing.
Nail on the head.
No matter the problem and no matter the potential punishment, there are always going to be people who decide that cheating is worth it.
Yes.
That's always going to happen. So because those guys get caught does not mean that the system is wrong. We still have laws and people commit crimes. We're not blowing up the legal system because of it. So I don't really understand. And, you know, again, it's just a bunch of crotchety dads who are like, another guy cheated who looks like a cheater now to me now and forever.
Cheating McCheater.
This is the point. This is how it's supposed to work.
Yes. So we can move on now. This
sucks
is,
for Gordon. But, I mean, last night, it was such weird timing.
Clearly, he knew what he was doing. And I wish, like, one guy would come out and just be like, "Guy, you know what? You got me. I really just wanted to get that fat contract and make that skrill."
You know, and
it's like, I didn't know that I took it. Like, okay, dude, like, clearly, you probably did.
And the statements that have come out from guys recently... like Chris Colabello's statement,
just like bawling on on TSN.
Yeah, they were like so. Yeah. And you know, I think with D. Gordon, it was this morning. He said, sort of, you know, this is what has happened. I did not knowingly do this. I have never knowingly, blah blah blah, like the standard boilerplate kind of thing. But Chris Colabello said, quote, "I'm saddened more for the impact this will have on my teammates, the organization, and the fans of the Toronto Blue Jays. I hope that before anyone passes judgment on me, they can take a look at the man that I am and everything that I've done to get where I am in my career." Okay, well, kinda, I guess, but like, dude, if you tested positive for a banned substance, that's on you. It's not good enough that you're a good guy. There are a whole lot of good people who have done really stupid stuff in life, but like, I don't know that that frame of mind doesn't work for me. And Chris Colabello, D. Gordon is the guy who you look at and go, "There is no way. I don't believe this at all." Chris Colabello played 6 seasons in indie ball before he gets signed by the Twins in 2012 and finally makes this rocket ascension into the big leagues. And so that's the guy that you would look at and think like, "Yeah, I can see it." So I just don't. I don't know, man. It's, again, there's always going to be cheaters. And the reason that you have rules, the reasons that you have a CBA that governs this, is to legislate that and to root those people out and to punish those people when they violate the rules. And it worked.
I think my favorite thing, though, is people saying that they should be able to have the team should be able to void contracts, basically, if a PED suspension comes about. It's like that would give the teams incentives to get out of bad contracts potentially sabotaging their own player.
Is going to be making $30 million a year for the next 6 years, and the Angels just decided, like, "Man, this guy sucks." Then, how do you know that that's not going to happen? It's just, the way that people react to the PED issue in baseball, you know, in the NFL, it's a 4-game suspension, and nobody ever talks about it again. Derek Wolfe got banged 4 games for PEDs in this town, and was a citywide hero in January and February.
Yeah, because he's good and stuff. He hits people hard.
Right. Could you imagine if that was, not even if it was Todd Helton, could you imagine if it was Troy Tulowitzki in 2008 when he was just a first-round pick who was starting to become good? That guy would never, ever hear the end of it. Ever.
We all know the stories on Helton.
Yeah.
Wayne Hagen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like to take him out back in the woods.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But the way people react to steroids and PEDs in baseball is stupid, and that's
amazing.
Nothing new.
It's amazing.
Let's move on. Not a good week for the Colorado Rockies.
Not a good
Rockies.
Week for the old Colorado Rockies.
Not a good week. 1-5 on the first six games of a seven-game homestand. They were not helped out by an umpiring crew that was horrendous, but they also didn't play that well.
Yeah.
They rallied from six runs down and seven runs down in separate games and did not win either of them. Despite leading by three going into the ninth inning against the Dodgers on Sunday, blew that game, blew the extra innings game back on Wednesday. Not a fun homestand.
They've been really, really good at making huge comebacks and then
not
blowing it. Not finishing them off.
Yay!
They've allowed at least nine hits in five consecutive games. They've allowed nine runs in three of the last four. The pitching staff has not been good.
It's the antithesis of what we were talking about last week or 2 weeks
really,
ago.
Like almost the exact opposite of what we've been talking about last week. So in...
It was way more fun to talk about them like, hey, they've been surprisingly good.
In this five-game losing streak, the starting pitchers have an ERA of 9.90.
Whoa. That's not good.
In the last five games, the pitchers for the starters have gone 20 innings combined. They have walked 13 batters in that time. They have struck out 14 batters in that time. They've allowed five home runs, allowing opponents to hit at a 10-11 OPS. It is just, it has not been good. It has not been good. With the exception of John Gray's start, where he struck out 10 in five innings for the Dodgers on last Friday. And he gave up five runs in five innings. Three home runs. Or two home runs in the first inning. It has been bad. It's been really bad. It's been bad every single second of every single minute of this homestand, basically.
Yeah, basically.
Basically.
Not fun.
No. And the pitching
There's
depth...
really nothing fun about this homestand.
It's a big deal. The pitching depth of what we thought when... Well, when the season started, we have DLR, we have Lyles, we've got who's it's what, we got what's his name.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Pretty much all.
Yeah. Tyler Chatwood was coming back, Chad Bettis. And like, okay, well, the team has some depth until John Gray is ready. He was going to be ready a couple of weeks into the season, 3 weeks into the season, something like that. Like, okay, this team has depth. They've got guys in AAA. You got your Jeff Hoppins. You got your Chris Russins, your Christian Bergmans, guys who can make starts if need be. All right, this is good. It'll be fine as long as we don't need to, you know, throw Chris Russin into the rotation or Christian Bergman into the rotation. Like, those guys are pretty good as long men out of the bullpen. And here we are. It's not even May yet. And Chris Russin's in the rotation. Eddie Butler is probably going to be in the rotation right now. Christian Bergman is basically going to be in the rotation. Jordan Lyles in AAA, Jorge De La Rosa is on the DL, and all of a sudden we're sitting here before May begins, and we're just going, oh, God.
Yeah.
It's happening again.
There was that time when it was like, well, you know, I mean, once they get John Gray back, you know, they're only have to gonna go certain level of fifth starter incorporation before the season really gets rolling. Maybe they only have to use a guy one time. And then you get John Gray in, and you lose two dudes in Jorge De La Rosa and Jordan Lyles. So,
and John Gray has been very unlucky so far. Ryan Freemeyer, our pal on Twitter, had a great, great article this morning on just the historical unluckiness of John Gray over his first 11 starts in the big leagues. So go over and check that on Purple Row. It is an awesome article. Ryan did a tremendous job with it. But yeah, there's some stats you can throw out there. So his batting average on balls in play for John Gray this year, or in his career, is what, 413. It is 413, his batting average on balls in play. When players put the ball in play on John Gray, they are hitting at a 413 clip. They are Ty Cobb when they put the ball in play on John Gray through his first 11 starts of his career. Now, you can put that out, extrapolate it. That's not going to stand for the rest of the season, but just look at it through 11 starts. You go back as far as you can go back, basically. And through the first 11 starts, highest batting average on balls in play, John Gray is right at the top of the list. In fact, he's the only guy with at least 11 starts in the last 50 years to have a BABIP over 400. So, yeah, that is not going to remain. John Gray had a rough go of it against the Pirates. The Pirates, a great hitting team that rarely swings and misses. They had a lot of foul balls in that game. Got John Gray visibly frustrated. He made some good pitches, made some poor pitches. It's what you're going to see when a guy's coming back making his second start in a cold game. It wasn't great. But we saw what he could do last Friday against the Dodgers. He had 10 strikeouts in five innings. He started out poorly, gave up two home runs in the first inning, but came back. Established his fastball early on, was throwing a lot of strikes, which is very good to see. And he used his slider late to get swings and misses. It was a very encouraging outing. Like, the most encouraging five-inning, five-run outing you're ever going to see, basically. But the Pirates flustered him, and that's what's going to happen. Those are the growing pains you're going to see.
How impressive were the Pirates?
Oh, the Pirates. I mean, they're going to be an elite team this year. They've been an elite team for the last 3 years. They're just well-run in every sense of the word, which if you would have said that 10 years ago, they would have slapped you in the face.
Dan Lucero tweeted that night, the night of the extra innings loss on Wednesday, I think, he said, from everything I've seen from the Pirates this year, I expect them to win something over 120 games, which is really how that team looked. I mean, like, effective enough pitching, but God, that offensive approach, made John Gray throw like approximately 95 pitches per at bat. That's what it felt like.
He threw 96 pitches in 3 2/3 innings, so
they just
kind of
don't
close.
Bad at bats. They just don't have bad at bats.
Yeah, for them, I do worry about their rotation because
You feel like something gets held together with spit and duct tape like that.
Garrett Cole's great. Francisco Liriano has not been great this year, but he has been the last few seasons. He'll be fine. I worry about from the 3, 4, 5, really. But
thing that's scary, though, is they have Jameson Taillon and Tyler Glasnow who are basically waiting to go in AAA right now. That team, I mean, they're really coming into kind of the full scope of their window right as the Cardinals are falling off and the Cubs are going to be their big fight in that division. That's going to be a fun as hell division to watch this year.
Yeah, but are the Cardinals falling off? They're leading the league in runs scored this year.
Yeah, but it's kind of...
They're like second in the league in homers.
I just don't see them right now.
Diaz is hitting 450.
I don't see them right now as of the same caliber as... And maybe it's because I'm so nerdily prospect-focused, but there's just nothing in that system that compares to the Pirates or the Cubs system. So when you look down the road...
Until Alex Reyes comes back.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So like when you look down the road at...
Drugs.
The reinforcements that you're eventually going to have, there's so much more talent coming up in the Pirate system than there is in the Cardinal system.
And
but
Josh Bell, another big bat coming up too. And Gregory Polanco has signed his deal, and now he's all of a sudden the all-star everyone thought he was going to be.
Polanco. That home run Polanco hit to dead center.
Bomb.
Yeah. So, it was not fun. And I really don't enjoy watching Clint Hurdle have success. So, I mean, I don't have anything against Clint Hurdle. It's just...
No, listen. Whatever. We've discussed this on the podcast before. Clint Hurdle was not right for the Rockies when they were there. The team didn't like him. They came out afterwards after he got fired and said it was a mess working for him. He had no idea what he was doing. He would undermine players. He would pull players out of games for seemingly like minuscule offenses. And then he went to Pittsburgh and had a bad year, and then the team went to him and said, this is how we're doing things. We're going to be very analytically inclined.
Yeah.
You can be on board, or you can be fired.
That's the money point.
And he got on board. He embraced everything, and the team has taken off. And Hurdle's a very smart guy. And when the team is going well, there's nobody better than Clint Hurdle.
Yeah.
Because Clint Hurdle is the best interview you're going to find, especially for the media. Oh, my God. Clint Hurdle was brilliant.
He's a likable dude.
He's
guy. He's the big personality that walks in the room and yada yada. I mean, he's a likable guy. The thing about Clint Hurdle was if the Rockies of the mid to late 2000s were the New York Mets, if they were the Los Angeles Dodgers, if they were the Chicago Cubs, they would have been the subject of 15,000 word Grantland think pieces on how to
rest in peace, Grantland. Come on, dude.
I can't believe I just said Grantland. Grantland. Nobody ever said that correctly. Grantland. It was named after a sports writer named Grantland Rice because Bill Simmons sucks and can't think of anything on his own, so we just steal somebody else's name. It's not Grantland. It wasn't an amusement park. But they would have been subject.
We're just getting deeds to land.
Going over to Grantland.
Going to Grantland. I'm going to go sign some papers.
They would have been the Grantland think piece team extraordinaire on how to conjure up as many power struggles in one office or one clubhouse as humanly possible. Because there was Dan O'Dowd against Dick Monfort. There was Dan O'Dowd against Bill Guyvett. There was Dan O'Dowd against Clint Hurdle. There was Clint Hurdle against Todd Helton or Clint Hurdle against George Lewicki or Clint Hurdle against Bill Guyvett or whatever. Yeah. It was all of these things of like, this team has so much going for it and is killing itself because it cannot figure out the way to operate effectively and efficiently.
And
so,
then you have the weird Christian thing overhanging everything with the USA Today article. And fascinating stuff.
Yeah,
and
I mean, like, it really would have been a very fascinating
phenomenal
thing.
Talent on that team. You had early Matt Holliday coming into his own. You had early Troy Tulowitzki.
Garrett Atkins was very
Garrett
good
Atkins,
back then.
Brad Hopp
was good back then.
Spilly, of course.
So that would have been fascinating. But when Clint Hurdle, the difference was when Clint Hurdle went to Pittsburgh, I'm pretty sure that Neil Huntington and the brass with the Pirates sat him down at some point and said, yeah, this isn't your show, man.
Yeah.
Which nobody did here.
Yeah, which is how
we're going to tell you how to manage.
How it should be run.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to give you the players. We're going to give you the information. We will establish an organizational philosophy that you will follow as an employee of the organization. And Clint Hurdle, to his infinite credit, has done an extraordinarily good job becoming that guy. So
completely embraced.
Good for
it.
Clint Hurdle. Good for Clint Hurdle. It just sucks thinking like, oh yeah. It's like seeing an ex who just moved on to such better things than you.
Yeah.
You know? And then it's just like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you see Walt amble slowly out of the dugout to have a conversation, you know.
And then get thrown out and then amble slowly back to the dugout and then not say anything.
I love Walt. He's such a nice guy, and I don't wish bad things upon Walt, but it was that's a terrible sentence. I don't wish bad things upon Walt, but I hope
he gets fired and loses everything and has to,
I think it's all coming to a head. He wasn't a Jeff Breidich hire. This is a topic for a different podcast, but
yes.
Wasn't a Jeff Breidich hire. It was a terrible hire when it was made.
It's been
a terrible tenure ever since. Like, I love Walt Weiss. I think he's a great guy. He's one of my all-time favorite Rockies to play here. You know, he was my dad's favorite player. I remember when the Rockies were the youngsters that they were when he came over in 94. That's a weird thing about Walt Weiss's career. He was a starting opening day shortstop for the Marlins in the first game of franchise history in 93, and then was a starting opening day shortstop the second season of Rockies franchise history, the other expansion team that year. But, like, there's a lot of good memories with Walt Weiss. Walt Weiss's managerial career is not one of them.
Nope. Not a single moment, I don't think.
So at some point, we'll have to save that for a little bit later podcast when this really starts getting uglier. But
it starts spiraling out of control.
But yeah, man, John Gray, I think, is what we were talking about.
Was it?
John Gray's going to be fine. Like, his stuff looks disgusting. That at bat against Andrew McCutchen, where he just froze McCutchen on the kind of between letter and belt high slider. Yeah.
When McCutchen was like 5 for 6 with 4 homers in the series.
And Cutch just turned around and walked back to the dugout. Like, that is John Gray. The little broken bat bleeders and the 1,000 hop bouncers
Holy
that get through
hell.
The infield, like, that's just frustrating. But I was talking with Jeff Donahue, who is the kind of the Rockies video guru over at Coors Field, the head of the video production staff. I think he's the head of the video production staff. I was talking to him yesterday after that game got banged, and Jeff and I were talking about, like, those are the games that you need. When you're a young guy, especially when you pitch at Coors Field, you have to have those games where you think, like, how in the hell does anybody ever pitch here? Because those are the only ways that you can acclimate. And Jeff brought up the point, when you look back at, you know, the way Jeff Francis' career started, or the way Aaron Cook's career started, or the way Ubaldo Jimenez's career both started and is still, those guys had their struggles at Coors Field much the same way that John Gray did and does and is. But you have to have those if you're going to be effective at Coors Field.
Yeah, I completely agree. So
there are a lot of positives to take out of that.
It's too bad that we're talking about the depth already, because, you know, it's not even May yet, but the rotation went from,
I had a great tweet cooked up,
De La Rosa, Bettis, Lyles, Chatwood, Gray, to now Bettis, Chatwood, Gray, Butler, Russin. Again, Chris Russin has been great this year out of the bullpen.
I think Bailey's going to be in there.
Yeah. Yeah, John Thompson's coming back.
Jerry DePoto will make a return.
Yeah, but we've seen how this game plays out with Chris Russin in the starting rotation. Like, he's just aside from the complete game shutout he had against the Padres, I believe, he's not a guy you want to see face a lineup 3 times. And that just makes your bullpen work more, and they get taxed like they have been already. And it's not where you want to be at the end of April.
Not at all. Not at all. Jeff Hoffman's not coming up. So we need to put that to rest. Jeff Hoffman's not on the 40-man. He's just getting his first exposure in AAA. He's not coming up anytime soon. So
he's doing well, but
we've gotten that question a lot. Yeah. Like, yeah, he's doing well, and that's great. It's a very good thing to see, but we're not going to see Jeff Hoffman in the short order at all, and we're not going to see Jeff Hoffman this season. I mean, I'm ready to. I
would say this season we'll see him.
I don't think we will. He's not a 40-man guy. So somebody has to lose a job in order to get him on the roster, which I think is a massive complication in itself. And he's going to be heavily limited because it's his first full. It's not just John Gray. John Gray had the full season with Double A Tulsa prior to last year, where they still had him on an innings and pitch limit. Jeff Hoffman hasn't even pitched a full minor league season yet, and he's coming off of Tommy John surgery, which John Gray did not have to deal with. So, yeah, he's been really good, but I don't know if I see it. I mean, if he continues throwing, you know, with an ERA under 2, then, yeah, I would imagine. But I don't know. I just don't see it happening this year.
I see midseason. I see around July 1st.
Okay.
If he needs to do well and is healthy, of course, yeah.
All right.
Standard caveats apply. But all right. I think The other big issue that we've seen with the Rockies in terms of injuries, we saw DLR go on the DL, Jordan Lyles get sent down for ineffectiveness. Charlie Blackmon going on the DL was a big turning point in this season for the Rockies. Charlie Blackmon, we've said this on the podcast before. When we started out, he had that big first half, was an all-star in 2014, and then just cratered in the second half. So we're like, oh, okay, well, one-hit wonder, Coors creation. Even we were on that train. The media in this town was just like, oh, Chuck is so wild with his beard, and oh, wow, what a wacky guy.
He drives an old Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Oh, that's so cool. Charlie Blackmon has become a very, very improved all-around talent who has been a linchpin for this team for the last couple of years offensively. He's turned himself into a very, very viable, normal big leaguer. So when he went on the DL, the Rockies had a problem because he's their leadoff hitter, he's their starting center fielder, and they have been an absolute desert from the leadoff spot since he has gone on the disabled list. Here's some stats. These are National League ranks. Since he went on the DL, they've hit 155, which is last in the NL. They have an OBP of 180, as last in the NL. These are Rockies leadoff hitters. They have only walked twice, tied for 12th in the NL. They have scored only 5 runs, as tied for 13th in the NL. And they've hit only 1 home run in that time. The 5 starting leadoff hitters in that stretch, Kristen Adames, Brandon Barnes, DJ LeMahieu, Gerardo Parra, and Trevor Story. They have mixed and matched, and Walt's been trying to find somebody in the leadoff spot who can do what Charlie does. And right now, nobody can do that. Without Chuck, they're 6-9 this season in the starting lineup. Yeah, exactly. Very nice. The team is hitting about 50 points lower than they were with Chuck in the lineup, 309 with, 256 without. The OBP drops 50 points, 371 to 319. They are averaging 2 fewer runs per game, 6.7 with Chuck, 4.8 without him. Clearly, small sample size, caveats apply, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. The point is Charlie Blackmon is a very, very integral part of this team. But the good news is he should be back tonight, today's Friday. Should be back for Friday night's game at Arizona tonight. He has been rehabbing in Modesto. Bobby DeMuro was all over that in Modesto and reporting back to the Purple Row front lines. So that's good news for the Rockies. At the very least, a silver lining coming back is that Charlie Blackmon should be in the lineup tonight against Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've discussed a lot that we were wrong about Charlie Blackmon, and he was with Class A Advanced Modesto for a rehab appearance. And the thing I liked about it, Keaton Gologly tweeted out, there was a ground ball that Charlie hit, you know, on the left side of the infield in like the 7th inning of a rehab game that he busted down the line to try to beat out. And, you know, I mean, we're guys who've been around rehabbing major leaguers in front of minor league teams, and that stuff carries over. I mean, when you're a 20-year-old, a 22-year-old, and you're stuck in a point of the season where it feels like things are miserable, or your team's falling apart, or you're not playing for the postseason, you're not playing for a promotion, whatever it is, it's easy to shut it down and not really care. When you see somebody like that, Charlie Blackmon, come down and show off like, no, this is how I do it. This is what a major leaguer does.
This is how big leaguers do, exactly.
Yeah, then that's what players remember, that stuff. So I think that was really cool. And I mean, I'm willing to admit that I was way too harsh on Charlie Blackmon.
Oh, hell yeah.
Ago, you know.
Hell yeah. Yeah, we both were, and we freely admitted that on the podcast.
Yeah,
we were totally wrong. Charlie Blackmon is a fantastic part of this team right now. And the thing is, when you see the player he has become from what he was, he used to be kind of guy who didn't really take his walks, took a lot of hacks, went up there and just kind of free swinging a little bit. This year, for whatever reason, he had really changed his approach. The numbers weren't all there for Charlie Blackman yet this season. He was hitting just 185 in those six games, no home runs, three RBI, but he was seeing nearly five pitches per plate appearance, and you put the minimum at, you know, 20 at-bats, whatever Chuck had at that point, and he's fifth in the league in pitches per plate appearance. He was seeing 4.7 pitches per plate appearance, which is, it's like Mike Napoli, Odubel Herrera, who guys who were in the near the top of the league in walks, and Blackman's right there. He's doing what a leadoff hitter should be. There was, I think, opening day, he saw like 35 pitches in his five at-bats. It was some unbelievable number. He had gone through spring, had a good spring, and his approach when he went in from the leadoff spot was, all right, I'm going to see the pitches, let the pitcher, you know, throw his entire repertoire at me, let my guys behind me see what this pitcher has, see what he has on a given day, and if I strike out, great. If I walk, super. But if I get my hit, great. But he had two walks and two strikeouts in that time, so an even one-to-one split in his six games. And that's what you want to see from Charlie Blackman. He'll eventually end up getting his 10 to 15 home runs, depending on how many at-bats he gets. But he had changed his approach so much that he had become such a more impressive player, even in the small sample size that we saw him this year. And the Rockies need him back in a big, big way.
That was not a good homestand. They come home, they're above 500 on a homestand. You kind of think to yourself, like, yeah, you know, I mean, come in, get a series win.
Yeah.
Over the Dodgers, set yourselves up, you know, look at a split, hopefully against the Pirates, and then just everything went to hell.
I mean, and Chuck says he's hit 288 in 2014, 287 in 2015. He's stolen 71 bases in the last 2 years coming in. He's hit 36 homers. He's just a guy who kind of does a little bit everything for you. And if he had learned like a solid plate discipline, he had a 347 OBP last year, which is pretty good for a leadoff hitter. But if he can improve that to 380, 390, something like that, with his production that he has, man, could be a really, really good player.
It'll be good to have him back. Didn't think that we would reach a point where I would say that, like, we'd be
God,
so desperate.
Like,
thank God Charlie Blackman's coming back. But, you know, that's what a 1-5 homestand will do to you with a terrible offense and terrible pitching and terrible health and terrible umpiring and terrible weather. So it's been a hell of a couple of weeks around these parts, let me tell you.
Terrible everything, man. Just a lot of terrible everything. And it doesn't help that Trevor Story is struggling in the last 11 games, too. We knew the league was going to figure out Trevor Story. We knew that was going to happen. That was always going to be the case, as it is with every single player.
I had a dream last night that Jose Reyes came back and they sent Trevor down to Albuquerque to cover the Super 2 thing, and Reyes was starting tonight. Whoa.
Oh, God. You suck.
Which, just as an aside, now, 2.5 weeks ago, Rob Manfred said that a decision would be coming on Jose Reyes in days, not weeks. And that was now 24 days ago, I believe.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure he said that on the 5th.
Yep.
So that's good to know.
Yeah.
Maybe they just forgot about him. Like, have you ever been in a doctor's office and, like, they're like, okay, just wait here and somebody will be in to take you out and then nobody ever comes? Maybe that's it.
Do you think that he just literally forgot that there's a team in Colorado?
Probably.
And he's like, oh, yeah, whatever, it's fine.
Probably. The Rockies. God. Rocky hockey.
Rocky. Rocky.
I
we
remember.
Have a team called the Rockies?
I remember Rocky hockey. Says Rob Manfred. I don't. I was not alive.
Yeah.
It was just a joke.
Trevor Story in the last 11 games hitting just 159.
Not good.
Not good. He did hit his ninth home run of the season on Wednesday, which broke the National League record for rookies in the month of April. He's on pace to break
one off the major league record.
Break the rookie record for home runs and strikeouts in a season. So that's cool.
Yay!
He struck out 19 times in the last 11 games. He has walked 6 times. It's not like he's not having productive at bats. That's not the case whatsoever. But as we've mentioned before in this podcast, he is going to take a lot of pitches, which he has been doing, and he is going to strike out a lot. He will walk, but right now he's second on the team. But behind Charlie Blackman, really, in pitch per plate appearance, he's taken 4.5 pitches per plate appearance. When you go deep into counts, you're going to strike out. Guys who go deep into counts, unless you're Joe Mauer, you're going to strike out a lot. And that's how it works, especially when you're a young player who hasn't really gotten his chance to get his feet wet in the big leagues for more than 3 weeks. But like right now, Trevor Story is in the top 10 in all of baseball in seeing pitches. And the list in front of him are some really, really good hitters. So the pitches per plate appearance leaders in all of baseball this year among qualified hitters: Mike Napoli, Odubel Herrera, Mike Trout, Hunter Pence, Troy Tulowitzki, Will Myers, and Alex Gordon, and then Trevor Story is number 8.
That's a pretty good group.
That's a pretty good group. And there was a great article, I'm trying to remember who wrote the article recently, about Trevor Story, what his numbers might extrapolate to have put out for a full season. And Alex Gordon was a comp that he had, because when Gordon came up initially as a third baseman.
Where did he go to college?
Oh, he went to Nebraska.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I was there at that time.
Yes. But when Gordon came up as a third baseman, he was seen as going to be the second coming of George Brett. He was going to be the guy who's going to lead the Royals back to prominence, back to World Series. And he did, eventually.
Eventually. After Gordon, position change and a whole lot of struggle.
And like a decade. Yeah. Alex Gordon was really, really terrible for a long time. Good number of years. Alex Gordon, his first 4 years of his career, 07 through 2010, he was bad. His OPS was in the low 700s.
703 in 2009 was his worst. Now, he only played 49 games that year, but he basically averaged an OPS around 740. 725 in his debut season, 151 games. 783 the next year, decent year, at age 24, his age 24 season for the Royals in 08. And then 703 in 49 games in 2010. 671 in 2010 was the number. The 703 mark was in 2000. Yeah. Sorry.
But then in 2011, position change, went from third base to left field, completely turned around his career, and then he led the Royals to a World Series.
And won the first of 4 straight gold gloves.
Yes.
And he has also made 3 straight All-Star appearances over the last 3 years.
But yeah, the point of this article was that when he first came up, he was swinging and missing at everything. But he wasn't hitting home runs like Trevor Story was. He was just swinging and missing at literally everything. But Gordon eventually... Well, I'm not saying it's going to take Trevor Story 4 years to do this, but he made the adjustments, and then the league tried to adjust back, and he was one step ahead, and all of a sudden, he's a feared hitter now. He hits about 270 every year, and he'll pop 15 to 20 homers, and that's the kind of player he is. But so it's hardly rare for a player to come up and do this. And George Springer was the other comparison in there, where George Springer came up, struck out all the time, but also hit home runs. It was a very exciting player, and... So the comps are there for Trevor Story to figure it out. And I like the fact that he's not giving away at bats, even if he is struggling. I mean, even in the last 3 games, he struck out 6 times, but he only has 1 hit in that time, which being the homer on Wednesday against Pittsburgh. But he's walked 4 times. He's had productive at bats. He's moved runners over. Obviously, he struck out with the, you know, winning and go-ahead runs on base, but it was a pitch that was, you know, 8 inches off the plate inside, whatever. The point is that there are things you can point to in Trevor Story's line so far to say that, okay, this is going to be just a lull right now, but he will bounce back. And once things start kind of breaking more his way, I think we're going to see Trevor Story doing not what we saw the first 8 games of the season, because no one's ever going to do that again. But I think he's going to be a very productive player. I said the whole year, 250, 310, 480, basically, for Trevor Story, his line this year, which as a shortstop with, you know, 15 to 20 homer power, 20 homer at this point, considering the pace. I think you take that. I think you take that for sure.
Yeah, this was always going to happen. This is what happens to rookies. And, you know, we've been trying to stay a little bit level-headed about Trevor Story because people adjust. Baseball season is one continuously thrown boomerang. Eventually, you're going to be on top of the world. Things are going to feel great. Well, unless you're just not good, you know, which a lot of players are just not good. But, you know, if you're somebody like Trevor Story, it's not going to be like that opening series or like that opening week forever, because you are going to have holes that are exposed. You know, Trevor Story, I mean, back when he was in Modesto, that was the big knock on him, was dude struck out all the time. So at the major league level, and, you know, I mean, he vastly corrected that in AA and in AAA, but at the major league level, you are going to get exposed. That's what happens to baseball players everywhere. That's what happens to all of the guys in baseball. So it was going to happen at some point to Trevor Story. You know, now the question is, does he adjust back? Does he get back on one of those roles? Or is it more, can you at least mitigate the huge swings in that? Can you go from being the feast or famine guy to being a little bit more of a consistent performer offensively?
Yes, and that is going to be what we're going to see from Trevor Story, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks. Like, will these slumps turn into 2-3 weeks worth of slumps, and then the hot streak is a week? Or is it going to be a little bit more even keel? Is it going to be a week on, a week off, a week on, a week off? Well, so we'll see if he's going to be Brad Hopp or if he's going to be Garrett Atkins, where Atkins was more steady. Hop would go through crazy streaks where he would, you know, OPS, you know, 4 million for a month and then OPS 480 for the next month. So we'll see what kind of guy Trevor Story is, but this is still why you watch baseball. This is why you are a fan, because you want to see how these guys adjust. You want to see the development they're going to take, especially if you're a Rockies fan, because you're going to need to see the development here. You have to play that draft and development game, even though it's a scam, obviously.
Huge scam. Pirates never did it. The Cubs never did it.
Royals never did it.
The Royals never did it. The Mets have never done it. No team ever has developed its own talent.
Ever drafted and developed homegrown talent and won a World Series. The Giants have never done it.
It's never happened.
Yeah.
Nope. And the teams that spend huge money these days are
wildly
successful. The New York Yankees, obviously, the last few years have been just giants on the landscape. Yeah, the Los Angeles Dodgers.
The last 6 years, the Dodgers have won every World Series.
They've tied to win the World Series the last six years with the Yankees.
Yeah.
So it always happens.
Yeah.
Let's talk
about the Red Sox won the World Series last year, too, actually. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was a three-way World Series.
Yeah.
Sensual baseball. Let's talk about Eddie Butler.
Okay.
Talk about one Eddie Butler.
Edward.
Because Edward returned to the Rockies this week, Timothy Edward Butler. And threw very well. Eddie came in 2 1/3 against the Pirates on April 27th. He struck out 4, which Anthony noted was actually one off of a career high.
It's just so sad. I'm sorry, Eddie.
And he allowed one inherited run.
Well, it was weird because
Wasn't it inherited?
Yes, because he came in relief of John Gray, got a ground ball, and Nolan threw him out at first. It was a close play.
Oh, right.
And like,
and it really Bob wasn't Davidson, that close of a play.
It wasn't that close of a play at all. Bob Davidson is the worst goddamn umpire. he made the out call. It was clearly not out. So the at bat continued.
Like, not even close.
Not even close.
Not
guy got a two
even
run
close.
Guy got a 2-run double after that, and then it was. I think that made it 7-0. So whatever that you know it. Whatever. Eddie Butler does not have a lot of experience relieving in his career. That's not something he has done.
That was his first major league relief appearance.
First major league relief appearance. And it was, he's only made one relief appearance in the minor leagues as well. And that was in Grand Junction in 2012. So he's not a guy who's just coming out of the bullpen, but he did a very impressive job from what we have seen Eddie Butler in the past. Last year, Eddie 3-10 in 16 starts in the big league, 79 1/3 innings, only struck out 44 batters, walked 42 at an ERA of 5.90 and a FIP that was actually worse. So what you wanted to see from Eddie Butler this year, you expected him to fight for a job in spring training. It didn't happen. So he went down to Albuquerque, had a bad first start. 4 innings, 4 runs, 7 hits, struck out 4, walked 3, got a loss at Tacoma. But in his last 3 starts with the Topes, went 6 innings in each. He gave up only 6 earned runs, only 1 home run, struck out 10, walked 3. So an ERA of an even 3. Then got the call back up thanks to the injury to Jorge De La Rosa. And then we saw him come in yesterday or Wednesday, and you saw swing and miss stuff from Eddie Butler, which is not something that we have been used to seeing from Eddie Butler. We saw it in 2013 when he ascended the Rockies minor league ranks. We go, oh, this is going to be the next coming for the Rockies. And he made Xander Bogaerts look stupid in the futures game. And that was going to be what he is. But we never saw that again from Eddie Butler. We never saw the swing and miss stuff that we were supposed to be seeing in the minor leagues. And he came in his 2 1/3 innings. He threw a lot of strikes in that time, which was very good to see. I think it was 29 of 41 pitches for strikes in that time for Eddie Butler. And he also got 7 swings and misses, 3 on his fastball, 1 on his sinker, and 3 on his slider. And that pitch is the important pitch for me. That's the sinker. Because we always heard growing up, few years ago, that Eddie Butler was we heard tell of Eddie Butler and his sinker. Well, we heard that Eddie Butler had this phenomenal bowling ball sinker that he combined with the swing and miss changeup, and that could get guys out and make them look stupid. It was a heavy pitch. And what we've seen in the big leagues is that he doesn't really throw that pitch that often. The sinker, it was used about 30% of the time in 2014. His four seamer 32%. Last year, his sinker was used only 23% of the time, 42% with his four-seam fastball. He used a lot more sliders and changeups. But obviously, small sample size, just one appearance. But what we saw from Eddie in that game against Pittsburgh, the sinker was used 40% of the time. Fastball, 27%. slider 19, which is the highest he's used in any major league game, and then the changeup at 11%. Obviously, like I said, it's one appearance. You can't base it off one appearance. But if that's what Eddie Butler needs to do, if that's the one weird trick, the BuzzFeed article that he used in Albuquerque after his first start to get more consistent, get more swings and misses, and then use that same strategy going into the big leagues, using that sinker more, that heavy bowling ball that he's supposed to have, then man, okay. If that's the difference with Eddie Butler, if that's what he needs to become, what at least even a shell of what we thought he was going to be 3 years ago, then man, all for it. You got to try something at this point, because this year is a big, big turning point for Eddie Butler. It could be a make or break season for him.
Not only that, not only is it kind of getting back to what made him successful from a stuff standpoint, but a mechanical standpoint too. Eddie Butler really got away from his own delivery, his own arm slot, and the way that he was successful from a mechanical standpoint. And that was really noticed last season, over the last couple of seasons, by some people from his past. Eddie Butler with former Major League pitcher Gary Lavelle worked after the offseason began last year on kind of getting back to what had made him successful. Now, on the one hand, that's a good thing. I mean, the Rockies, you know, they want to see a guy be successful using any means necessary. If it means, you know, discovering something from somebody who's got an outsider's perspective, okay, that's great. I actually have my best friend growing up is now an assistant softball coach at Radford University, where Eddie was a collegiate pitcher, was drafted out of Radford. And last year, after he was hired, was talking to, and I think I've told this story before, but was talking to some of the members of the baseball coaching staff. And that was the first thing they said to him was, man, they really screwed up Butler's delivery. So that was something that had been pretty evident to people outside of the inner circle with the Rockies, quote unquote. So good to see that Eddie Butler feels like he got it figured out. What is rough to see is that that's now multiple guys that the Rockies have had, highly touted prospects, that have had to go back and work with coaches outside the organization, Tyler Matzek being the other one. If you are a major league organization, not a reputation you want to get.
You shouldn't have to do that.
No, not at all.
You shouldn't strive to be the Orioles.
Not at all. So that's a little bit concerning. However, if it works, which it appears that it has, Eddie Butler was roughed up a bit in his first outing with AAA Albuquerque, 4 innings, 4 runs on 7 hits. But in every outing after that, he put up a quote-unquote quality start. 2 of those 3 came at home in Albuquerque, very difficult pitcher's environment. So he gave up 8 hits and 9 hits respectively, but only 3 runs in each and 2 earned runs in one of those starts. And on the road at Reno back on April 12th, and kind of his bounce-back start from the opener, a run on 4 hits over 6 innings, and the command was good. 14 strikeouts against 6 walks in 22 innings. That's huge. So to me, and we got this question for a little Ask PDP from Brian Kilpatrick a little bit ago, does it look like he's doing anything different physically than what he had done in past seasons? Yeah, I feel like it is. I don't have the scout's eye to be able to just look at Eddie Butler and say, yeah, I can see that. Obviously, this is a pretty clear change from the last couple of seasons. But that seems to be part of the big key to what has made him, or is making him, successful so far this season, is that he has figured out something that needed to be altered and figured that out over this past offseason, and now he's taking advantage of that.
It's about the swing and miss stuff. In 2013, he averaged about 8.5 Ks per 9. And like I said, we just haven't seen that. In the big leagues, his K per 9 was 4.9 last year. It was 1.7 in 2014. I mean, we just have not seen that whiff potential. He got swings and misses on 16% of all pitches last year. The league average is about 21, 22. And in his first appearance this year, 23%. So obviously it's a step in the right direction. And if he does make that start, I believe he is supposed to make a start potentially on Monday. That is when there's an opening in the rotation. So that would be at San Diego. Maybe not a terrible place for him to get some work in, a big ballpark and a team that's struggling. Who knows? We'll see what if he does get that start on Monday, we will have a much better barometer to see what we're going to get from Eddie Butler this year. If we see some guys going back to the dugout shaking their heads, okay, we'll take that. But it was a good building block for Eddie to begin this season. That's for damn sure.
I like it. I like seeing that from Eddie Butler, because I think people way too quickly have given up on him. And again, Eddie Butler is still 25 years old. Some guys don't get it figured out 3 years out of college. Sometimes it doesn't happen that quickly. That doesn't mean that Eddie Butler is not going to be an effective major leaguer or a very good major leaguer. This is a guy who going into last season was a top 100 prospect in all of baseball via Baseball America, MLB.com, and Baseball Prospectus. It's not like he just forgot how to do it. We've had that conversation before. So don't give up on Eddie Butler. And I think that start, yeah, could really give us an inkling of what it's going to be like going forward for him. And just kind of to Anthony's point, career strikeouts per nine in the big leagues, 4.7 against 4.5 walks per nine. Career strikeouts per nine in the minor league, 6.8 against 2.9 walks per nine. Command is something that can really abate and disappear from guys when they get to the big league level. But in a situation like Butler's, where it seems like he's discovered something mechanically that he needed to get fixed and now has that righted, then I think you start to see that come back into focus. You start to see the ability to get those strikeouts when you need them and to not be handing away free bases to guys. I think that's a huge key for him going forward. So I'm excited to see him get a start.
So unlike Eddie Butler, you know how some guys do figure it out really quickly? Brendan Rodgers is one of those guys who has figured it out pretty quickly.
Who?
Nobody. Just the Rockies first pick last year, third overall in the draft. Got his feet wet last year in Grand Junction, but now he is in low A Asheville as a 19-year-old. His slash line right now, 351 average in 19 games, a 422 on base percentage, a 622 slugging percentage. That is good for, just a 1044 OPS.
What? Is that good?
He's got 5 home runs. He's got 18 runs batted in. He's got 8 walks compared to 14 strikeouts. He has multi-hit games in each of the last 5. Scored 18 runs. He's even 2 for 2 in stolen bases. I would say that's okay. Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad. He has only not reached base in 1 game this year.
That's also pretty good.
It's also not bad. Also not bad at all. So Brendan Rodgers, let's talk about him for a second. Dude's 19 years old. He will turn 20 on August 19th. He is still very, very young for the South Atlantic League. And right now, he is destroying the Sally right now. He only is getting better, too. Every time I keep looking at his numbers, I go, oh, check out a box score. Oh, Brendan Rodgers, 2 more hits. Oh, another homer. Oh, a couple runs batted in. Okay. That's great. Guys are hitting. Guys are hitting. Guys are liking it. People are really, really impressed with their scene from Brendan Rodgers right now in Asheville.
Brendan Rodgers is, I don't think people realize what a talent they got. Because the headlines, and to some extent deservedly so, but Alex Bregman and Dansby Swanson, the two guys who went ahead of him in the draft, Swanson with the first overall pick to the Diamondbacks and now in the Braves system, and Bregman with the Astros, they're going to get more hype because they played at a higher level, Bregman at LSU and Swanson at Vanderbilt. And they're more advanced in the minor leagues right now. Bregman is at AA Corpus Christi and Swanson's at Class A Advanced Carolina. But of those three talents, Brendan Rodgers is the best talent, has the highest ceiling. And I don't think that people realize just how good he is. When Troy Tulowitzki was drafted, different circumstance because, again, a college guy, more polished, is going to have a shorter road to the big leagues. But with Brendan Rodgers, his ceiling is as high as any position player the Rockies have drafted in a very long time. I mean, David Dahl definitely comes to mind, but Brendan Rodgers, he's the real deal. And to be doing that at 19 years old in the South Atlantic League, I'll be fascinated to see how the Rockies challenge him because, again, just like Trevor Story, there will be a stretch where pitchers get Brendan Rodgers figured out for a spell. Do the Rockies stick with him this whole season? Do they let him go through that at Class A Asheville? Or do the Rockies decide, no, let's give this kid a shot in the California League and see how he performs out there? You know.
They have been hesitant to move guys up multiple levels in a year, especially the higher prospects, your Raymel Tapia, your David Dahls, your Ryan McMahons. It's been rare when they have tried to do that as of late, in the Jeff Breidich era, I should say. So considering his age, I'd be shocked if they moved him up, but if he keeps hitting Sally League pitching at a 350 clip into July, I don't know. I think they might do what they did with David Dahl and bring him by. But also it was Dahl's second year in Asheville because he had the aborted season where he got suspended and then got hurt almost immediately, missed that whole season. He was back in Nashville the second year, played very, very well, got moved up to Modesto midseason, and then dropped back for the Sally League playoffs with Asheville. They eventually won the Sally League title that year. I'd be surprised if they moved him up considering his age, but I mean, with a pick, with a pedigree like he does, if he keeps responding the way he has so far, then why not? Sky's the limit for that guy.
I am excited to see the way that goes for the rest of the season because, yeah, he's really good. He's really
and
good.
Speaking of guys who are really good as well, David Dahl, he is putting up some very, very impressive numbers in Hartford right now. The strikeouts were a big issue with Dahl early on. He had multiple strikeouts in five of his first six games of the season. He had a five-strikeout game as late as April 18th. But since that game, something has changed with David Dahl, and it's a very, very good thing. In seven games since that five-strikeout game at New Hampshire, he is hitting .381. He's hit a couple home runs, driven in six. He has walked seven times in those last seven games and only struck out three times. He has gone four consecutive games without a strikeout. His OPS is over 1,300, actually over 1,400 in that time. He has four doubles as well. So, and also David Dahl, by the way, he just turned 22 at the beginning of April. So the league, the AA, was not kind to him early on. He was swinging and missing a lot, but something has gone on in the last week with David Dahl where you're seeing the progression, you're seeing the adjustment, you're seeing the type of player that he can be. Guys can make adjustments on the fly like that, whether it's in game, in a week, in an at-bat. You need to be able to do that in baseball. And it's no surprise that in that time, the Yard Goats, they've won six in a row. They're 6-1 in that time.
Eat it up.
Yeah, eat it up. Eat it up. Eat it up. Yeah.
Eat it up.
The Yard Goats are good, by the way. And David Dahl is a big reason why they are so good. And whatever he has done, whatever the change was made in his approach, man, like you keep looking at the numbers. Right now he's slashing .274, .361, .644 in 19 games for the Yard Goats. Man, those numbers, like you see that progression like that? That is sexy. That is a sexy slash line for David Dahl.
He's just so good looking.
He also has three steals in the last two games too. He's 5-for-6 this year in stolen bases.
He really can do everything. He's a five tool guy. He can do absolutely everything. Man, that team is, it's going to be so cool. It's going to be so cool for those people in Hartford. It's really just about a month away now. They're going to get that ballpark, the gates thrown open, and that team will be an actual team at home. And that's going to be awesome. That'll be really cool.
50 game road trip to begin the year and they're 16-4. They went on the road for the entire month, and they, one, haven't killed each other yet.
Yeah. Well, we don't know.
I remember even 7-8 game, 9-day road trips in the minor leagues. You just want to strangle everybody by day six.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, you want to do that at home, too.
It's fair. But at home, you can separate yourself.
That's true. You can go to your own place of residence.
And that's the difference. They're 16-4.
Here's a little pull behind the curtain for the world of minor league baseball for all y'all. The idea of the road trip sounds miserable. And it sounds like, oh, God, those poor guys are not going to have a place to live, whatever, that sucks. But I think of everybody that I've talked to on all these teams, on El Paso 2 years ago, on Biloxi last year, Yard Goats this year, I haven't talked to anybody with them yet, but I would assume it's the same way. The guys really like it because, one, you don't have to worry about a place to stay. You don't have to worry about bills and rent and utilities and all that nonsense.
You get your
get per diem every day. And if you're a 27th round pick who got a $3,000 signing bonus and you're making $1,100 a month, that $35 a day or whatever that is, that's a substantial portion of your income, which is sad, but it's true, man.
It can add up.
It does. Yeah. And, we've both been in that boat. I can't tell you how many times I would walk down the little highway to the subway in Kinston so I could get a $5 footlong and save my other $30 for the day. Because when you're not making any money, that's a huge thing. So the players, I think, like that to a certain extent because you don't have to worry about all the extracurricular stuff.
Yeah, that's what people don't get about. And this could be a whole other podcast itself, just the minor league baseball players union. And we talked about the major league baseball players union, how incredibly strong it is and how unbelievable the power that union wields. The minor league baseball players, they don't see a dime of that. minor league baseball, you basically, if you're in minor league baseball, you live off your signing bonus. If you're a first round pick, you got $4.8 million. You're going to be just fine in the minor leagues. Like I said, if you're a 27th round pick or a 40th round pick who got $1,000 to sign, you are working for peanuts, basically, because you don't get paid much. It's long hours. You have to be there at all times. By the way, if you don't do well, you could get sent down or released at the drop of a hat, and then your what you spent your entire life trying to shoot for, it could be over. Just
now,
like that.
Imagine if you're a prospect from Mexico or from the Dominican or from Venezuela or wherever, and your family back home is counting on you to send back a sizable portion of your income as well. That's why guys live, eight guys do a two-bedroom apartment, so they can all pay $150 a month in rent, because things suck for minor leaguers.
We should do an entire podcast.
We should do that. Yeah. It'd be a lot of fun.
If you're a boss at MLB,
we'll yell at us for showing how the sausage is made.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go with an Ask PDP before we get out of here for the 72nd edition. We got a good one in the old email box. You can email us, purpledinosaurpodcast@gmail.com. And our good pal Will emails in this question. Quote, why are Major League umpires and the Umpires Union continuing to be such dicks about implementing some form of electronic ball and strike calls? The technology is available right now to do so. Even if there was a compromise that gave umpires their discretion on the high-low strike call, since that does change each at-bat, the width of the plate is never going to change. Fair point. The issue with these inside-outside pitches can be resolved in just a few days. If a part of my job required me to be as accurate as possible and there was some tool /app/etc. that allowed me to get as close to 100% accuracy as possible and I didn't use it because of my own personal stubbornness and ego, I would have been fired yesterday.
Also accurate.
Yeah. And Will, you can follow him on Twitter. He is at Will_E_777. I think it's a great question. This is what I would equate it to. And maybe it's an insulting comparison. But when they got the automated checkout lines in grocery stores, that caused a bit of a stir because people thought this is the slippery slope to people losing jobs everywhere. And I think to an extent, that's the reason behind the hesitancy from the umpires and especially from the union, is if we start on a road where it's a robot umpire that judges the corners, then where does it stop? Then are there sensors in the bags and in first baseman's gloves to determine if guys are out? Do you have the tracking software that down the lines acts like, you know, the tennis court footage where you can tell within seconds of a ball that's on the line, is that fair or foul? Is it in or out in tennis? I think that's it. Is that a good enough reason? No, because it's a sport. It's not like we're making decisions on drone pilots. So I don't think Major League Baseball is ever going to look at it and say, yeah, just get rid of umpires altogether, because that's part of the fabric of the sport, and no sport clings to its history and its identity the way baseball does. So they're never going to do away with umpires. So I very clearly see Will's point. If this is something that can improve the game, then I don't know why it isn't studied or looked at more closely. And I think that's the reason why, because I think people just don't want to walk down that road.
The human element will always be there in terms of umpiring in baseball.
Make it good necessarily.
Not necessarily. But there needs to be more checks and balances in play for performance. Players get judged for performance. Managers get judged for performance. GMs get judged for performance. I don't feel like there is enough of an iron hand when it comes to judging how good or how poor these umpires are. You say, oh, well, you know, they get picked to go umpire the World Series. Great. But we've seen a lot of terrible umpires get picked to go umpire the World Series. I think there's got to be a system where the Major League Baseball tried this a while back with Questech. Remember that? The Questech system where, you know, Curt Schilling famously took a bat to it after the umpire. He didn't think the umpire was giving it strikes. And that's when we all thought Curt Schilling was he's somewhat lovable.
And he was,
a hero at that point.
Yeah. And Questech, beyond that, Sports Illustrated, I think, did a really big investigative story into that. But Questech was like a very scammy company.
It was like
too.
A third-party company.
Yeah, it was weird. They were laundering money. It was not a good thing.
So, but I think there should be a system in place where we have pitch effects. We have the technology. We can rebuild the system. Where if you have an umpire And you can get this on Brooks Baseball. It's open to the public. You can see where the strike zone is and the plots where it's called. You can see where the pitches come in. We have this technology now. If an umpire drops below a certain percentage of pitches that should be in the strike zone that aren't called strikes or vice versa, then they should be dinged for performance. Whether it's, I don't know about suspending guys necessarily, but you should have more of...
There should be tools for
it. Yeah, there should be a tool there in place where you can get judged on your performance. You could get demerits. You can get promoted, whatever. Because there should be guys who are good at their jobs at the highest level. And right now, I don't think that is the case. And that's been a problem in Major League Baseball for a long, long time. So that's my thing. I think there should be a system where people can, where umpires can be judged like players are judged.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the more that we see umpiring come into question in big moments, that's what ends up making the changes. That's what ended up getting replay on an enhanced basis in the challenge system and whatever. That's also what ended up really, in effect, causing the change because of Chase Utley's slide. I mean, that's a rule that's dictated because the umpires did not really have any recourse there. So, yeah, it's a player safety thing, but it's also an officiating the game issue as well. So, I mean, it kind of sucks to say it, but I think you have to see something big decided on a blown call before you really start to see that groundswell of change reach the league office. I mean, Armando Galarraga's perfect game is the perfect example.
Yeah.
With replay, that's a perfect game. And Armando Galarraga goes down to baseball history. And instead, Jim Joyce goes down to baseball history because he's the guy who blew it. So I think that's what has to happen. And that's really not the way it should go, but that seems to be the only way that baseball... And this is a problem for baseball that dates back a century. Baseball ignored the gambling problem, said there was no gambling problem. Then there were teams throwing World Series. Baseball ignored the greenies problem, the amphetamines problem. Then that was a problem when Ball 4 came out from Jim Bouton. Baseball ignored the PEDs problem, and obviously we know what's going on with that still to this day. And baseball ignores an umpiring issue, which, you know, not necessarily the integrity of the game, the way those things are. But this is a long time baseball. As old as any baseball
I think
tradition.
I think it's the integrity of the game. It's umpiring. Yeah. It's the rules. It's,
right,
it's
but I don't think it's the integrity of the game. I think it's malicious, though, in the way that throwing games due to gambling or PEDs, all that kind of stuff. That's, you know, kind of the way that I meant it. But I think baseball, the oldest tradition in baseball is approaching problems with a somewhat head in the sand, I can't hear you mentality. So eventually it'll change. It just might be a little bit slower road to change.
Right, and you would hope that Manfred would be on the forefront of that. But, I mean, the domestic violence issue with Jose Reyes, I think the longer that drags on, the more questions I have for Rob Manfred.
Man. D. Gordon gets a whole lot more flack for testing positive for PEDs than Jose Reyes did for throwing his wife allegedly into a glass door. I don't recall Buster Olney coming out and saying the Rockies should have the option of voiding Jose Reyes's contract. I don't recall that.
No.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Are we blocked by Buster Olney because we disagree with him once? Is that how that works?
What?
Are we blocked by him? Are we blocked by Buster Olney?
No, I don't think so.
Should we? Should we try?
It probably wouldn't take long. I don't think we're blocked by, I so rarely read Buster Olney to be perfectly, I so rarely read anything at ESPN to be honest with you.
Well, same for me.
So that's,
but anyway, thanks for the question.
Anyway,
Will.
Thanks for the question, Will. And, Will's follow-up question was, when are we going to, do live play-by-play on the 93 Rockies video that he found on YYouTube? We do need
to do that. Yes, we do.
Maybe when things get terrible, we just won't talk about baseball anymore. We'll just do, we'll do that.
I like it. Let's do
we'll throw it back to another terrible sub-70 win team from 20 plus years ago. And, we'll talk about them instead of talking about the current one.
Sweet.
Yay. Sounds awesome.
Let's be a long one today. Let's wrap this one up.
Yeah, let's wrap this up. For next week, shoot us your questions, thoughts, comments, concerns. You can tweet at us, Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Purple Dinocast is the Twitter handle. Anthony is at Mastertones. I'm at Tyler Mon. You can also email us, purpledinosaurpodcast@gmail.com. And hopefully next week we'll have somebody on the show. I've gone down the last 2 weeks trying to get players for interviews. 2 weeks ago, wasn't able to get Trevor Story. Yesterday, they get banged before that game gets played, so couldn't get anybody post-game for there. So, next week, we'll have somebody on. Chris Jackson or Jason Hirsch or, I don't know, maybe President Obama will come on. Who knows?
Let's have Bobby DeMuro on. Oh, wait, he's going to England? Never mind.
Yeah, what? Yeah. England? It's baseball season. What is wrong with you?
They play round ball there.
Ah, I'll say rounders. Some cricket. Ah. All right. Until next week. Talk to you then. Bye.
Bye.